It's a funny place to be, stuck in a seemingly mundane world with an inner knowing that the universe is so much more than our mortal minds can comprehend. Yet we all have the capacity to know peace and our oneness with the wholeness of life. And through these interviews, discussions, and reflections, it is my intention to share this possibility. I'm Ryan Kurzak, and this is the Kriya Yoga Podcast. There are many books available these days on Kriya Yoga and meditation practice. And today I'd like to take some time to discuss the top four texts for one who wants to understand fully what it means to practice Kriya Yoga meditation and to understand what it means to live the life of a Kriya Yogi. Now, the first book, which I put as number four on this top four list, might surprise you. It's Autobiography of a Yogi. Some of you might wonder why I don't consider Autobiography of a Yogi as number one on the list. Primarily because Autobiography of a Yogi is a very inspirational book, and it tends to give people the information they need when they first find Kriya Yoga. It helps to inspire them to take up the path and to walk the path. Long term, I do find Autobiography of a Yogi to be a wonderful resource because eventually, as one begins to practice Kriya Yoga meditation, one starts to realize that the importance of Autobiography of a Yogi, aside from keeping one inspired, is to share principles about, in a sense, the mental framework that a Kriya Yogi has. All the stories that are shared within Autobiography of a Yogi, these are very fantastic stories, and the important part of them isn't their fantastic nature. The important part of these stories is the underlying message that Yogananda is aiming to share through the interactions with all the great saints and sages and gurus that he met. So when it comes to books on Kriya Yoga, I do find Autobiography of a Yogi to be extremely important, both in the beginning of one's search on this path and also long term to help them stay inspired, but also to tap into the consciousness of Kriya Yoga masters. Because within Autobiography of a Yogi, we have saints that don't sleep. We have individuals that don't eat. We have people that supposedly have two bodies, meaning they can be in two places at one time. We have saints and sages with massive amounts of strength, those that can disappear at will or materialize things. Now, that is like a candy coating for the mind. And again, reading behind the words of those stories, you will find the consciousness of those saints, of those sages, of those gurus, because ideally they are not identified with those majestic powers that they have. But they have those majestic powers because they recognize their oneness with the wholeness of life. And oneness, unification, that is the essence of yoga practice. That is what it's all about. Now, you'll find that as you begin to practice meditation, as you begin to clarify your consciousness and clarify your awareness, you too may develop things like profound intuition, or you may get luckier in certain situations. But that's all side benefit. That's all because you are practicing a meditation technique where you are living in such a way that you are in harmony with life. And you'll find that when anyone or anything is in harmony with life, it tends to thrive. The consciousness of that person, being, creature, tends to thrive. So when it comes to Autobiography of a Yogi, I find this to be a wonderfully inspiring text. But when individuals come to study Kriya Yoga with me or to participate in the 2-year Kriya Yoga apprenticeship program, we do spend some time at the beginning of year 2 discussing how to read Autobiography of a Yogi, to read behind the words, beneath the words, to see what is the message, what is the moral code, what is the state of consciousness that Yogananda is sharing through the demonstration of the stories with these wonderful masters of yoga. So Autobiography of a Yogi is number 4 on my top 4 list of important books to read for a Kriya Yoga practitioner. And the top 3, it's hard to tease those out. The 3rd most important book, and again, it was hard to determine where to put this in the order, is The Holy Science by Sri Yukteswar. Now, the reason The Holy Science by Sri Yukteswar is so important, not only because it is a direct writing by Paramahansa Yogananda's teacher, Swami Sri Yukteswar, not only is it important because, as the legend goes, it was Mahavatar Babaji himself, the originator of the Kriya Yoga practices in this current era. It was Mahavatar Babaji who instructed Sri Yukteswar to write this book. But the important thing about this book is, number 1, how it puts into perspective the idea of the yugas, or the great cosmic cycles that human consciousness goes through. Sri Yukteswar discusses this in the very beginning, and again, I encourage you to get the book and read it, and I will go ahead and put links to all of these books within the podcast notes for this episode. But in the beginning, Sri Yukteswar discusses this idea of the yugas, of the great cosmic time cycles, and he discusses how humanity goes through 4 stages. We need to think about this cycle as though it is a circle. It is circular. And there is an ascending stage where humanity passes from dark age consciousness to what's considered to be the electric age consciousness, and then into what's considered to be the silver age, or the age of mental understanding. And then finally, at the very top of the first half of this circle, we find that human consciousness reaches the golden age, or the age of enlightenment. And so the theory behind this is that humanity passes through these stages. And the ascending portion of this stage is a 12,000-year period. The descending portion of this stage is also a 12,000-year period. So once human consciousness ascends up through these ages, once it reaches its peak, it reaches the top of Satya Yuga, or the age of truth, then human consciousness begins to descend back from this age of enlightenment back to the mental age, and then back through to the electric age, and finally back into the dark age. So in a sense, it's circular. And this is based upon, the theory is that it's based upon the movement of our solar system from, the idea is that the solar system spins in a circle, just like the planets spin in a circle, just like the galaxy itself spins, and that the solar system moves closer to the galactic center during this initial 12,000-year period, and then as the circle keeps going, then the solar system moves away from the galactic center. And as our solar system moves towards the galactic center, human consciousness is able to perceive more clearly what is the truth of the nature of consciousness itself. As the solar system moves away from the galactic center, human consciousness loses its ability to perceive and understand the true nature of itself. And this happens cyclically. Now, I had a discussion with one of my friends about this, who's also a meditator, and he found it interesting, but he kept thinking that, well, why would we explain it this way, and why wouldn't we just consider it as though there are these cataclysmic things that kept occurring throughout humanity's history, sort of pressing the reset button? And I thought about that, and that makes sense, but if we pay attention to nature, we'll find that we have these kinds of cycles all the time. It's daytime, it's nighttime, things go to sleep, things wake up. There are seasons which pass from winter to spring to summer to fall and so on. There are all these cycles happening. And just like in the natural course of a human day, the individual wakes up, and then they become more alert, they become productive, and then they start to get a little more sleepy, they start to become a little more relaxed, and they go into a deep sleep, they stay there for a while, and then again they wake up the next day, and this continues in this kind of cyclical pattern. So the same is true for human consciousness. So it's not that humanity is being punished, or it's not that this is a difficult thing. It's difficult when you're a little human being, because when you're in the dark ages, you are destined essentially to pay attention to nothing more than probably sex, food, war, sleep, illness, and then that's it. When you get into the electric age, human rights become more important. Individuals are able to live more freely. When you get into the silver age or the age of the mental age, you'll find that all those stories that you hear about people that have fantastic mind powers or telepathy or clairaudience or healing with the mind, that becomes as common as war and poverty was in the dark ages. And then when you get into the golden age or the age of truth, that is when human consciousness is as close to the galactic center as possible. And so the main focus of human awareness, the main understanding of human awareness is that we would imagine the most enlightened person that has ever existed up to this point, that is the common state of consciousness for most people. So it's hard to understand these things because you can typically only understand based on your current level of consciousness. So this book is extremely important, The Holy Science, for a few reasons. Number one, it explains this rise and fall of human awareness, of human consciousness, of human capacity, spiritual capacity. And so if you pay attention to that, essentially what you're learning is that, we are existing in a time because this is where we happen to be on this particular circular pattern of the solar system as it rotates through the galaxy towards the galactic center and then away from it. But the wonderful thing that Sri Yukteswar, what he does is he then goes on to explain that by the practice of meditation, Kriya Yoga meditation, by learning to hear the pranava, or the, as he describes it, the Om vibration as it relates to what many Western traditions call the Word of God, as we are able to experience that, attune to that through our meditation, we actually begin to embody a clearer state of consciousness. And so we may, in the course of our lifetime, actually become a electric age individual, or a silver age individual, or a Satya Yuga, truth age individual. And that is really the purpose of our meditation practice. And each age can be associated with a particular stage of life. in the sense that in Indian traditions, we have a stage of life where we are focused on building up our resources. We're focused on maintaining order within the physical world such that things are stable. That can be likened to the Dark Age, the age when humanity really can't appreciate a whole lot more than just the physical senses, what it can experience with the physical senses. When we move into an electric age awareness, this is where we start to be able to experience joy or pleasure in a sense. Now, it is an actual physical kind of pleasure, but nonetheless, it is moving beyond just this basic survival need to start catching a glimpse of potential joy in life. And we see that because we are currently in the electric age. According to Sri Yukteswar's calculations, we entered this electric age around 1600 AD, and the Dark Age concluded around 1600 AD. And what we have seen is this emphasis truly on the individual. We've seen this emphasis on human rights. We've seen a decline in slavery. We've seen a decline in unfair treatment of individuals who aren't part of the top 1%. Now, of course, I understand there are many of you out there that see all the injustice in the world, and I see it too, so we're not ignoring these things. But as someone who likes to read, I've read a lot of history books, and I've read a lot of historical fiction. And there's one in particular, a YouTube video that I found particularly enjoyable. It was called Why You Would Be Dead By Now If You Lived in the Middle Ages. So if you go back and you do some research on what human life was like, even 200 years ago, even 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, you're going to see that while, yes, we still have problems with inequality and justice, that, well, there isn't a ruling class that can do essentially whatever it wants. We are no longer, at least in many industrialized cultures, enslaving people en masse. So this is a tricky subject, primarily because there are still issues that need to be worked out, but we have to consider that within this 12,000-year ascension cycle, we are only, about 1/8 into the ascending electric age, which you can understand all that if you read Sri Yukteswar's book, The Holy Science, which means we still have a long ways to go on this upward movement. Now, anyway, back to the point. You can become an electric age individual, and that's what we've just discussed, which then leads us to the mental age. And this is when you start to know people who have profound intuition, profound understanding of how the mind works and its influence on essentially matter and energy. You can even, through the practice of your meditation and Kriya Yoga practice, experience a Satya age, a truth age mentality. Now, that's not easy. To go anywhere beyond your current age is not necessarily easy, because you have to remember, in a particular age, human consciousness has a sort of baseline understanding of how it sees the world. So if you would begin to experience mental age or Treta Yuga, Silver Age mentality, more than likely, you wouldn't be able to relate with 98% of the people that exist in this world. If you experience Satya Yuga mentality, well, that becomes even less of an issue. You can relate to them because you are the one that has realized the truth of your own nature, but you really shouldn't expect them to understand you. The story of Jesus is a classic example of what happens when you take someone from a different kind of age, such as the Satya Yuga, and you introduce them into the Dark Age, which is when he was doing his work. Well, they didn't understand him at all, and they crucified him. But we don't need to go there, because as we know, as Kriya Yoga meditators, that we are meant to practice quietly, to let our understanding be what it is for ourselves and for the benefit of consciousness, of humanity, silently, instead of going out and trying to stir up trouble or try to push the river. And that's the important point that Sri Yukteswar shares. It's not necessarily obvious, but by telling you about the ages, he's essentially saying, look, this is where you are right now. This is where consciousness is going. And currently we are on an ascending arc. We are moving towards the point of reaching closer to the galactic center. Now, of course, it's many thousands of years away. Now, one more thing about this before we talk a little bit more about why Sri Yukteswar's book is so important. Many people, as you know, I have been a Vedic astrologer, and when you talk about these different ages, it is common for people to say, yes, but we're still in the Dark Ages. And again, Sri Yukteswar explains why people think that. But aside from miscalculations in old Indian texts, one of the primary reasons that we have this kind of confusion is because if you are of a Kali Yuga, that's the Dark Age, a Kali Yuga mentality, that's essentially all you can see. And so, of course, you're going to think that you are in the Kali Yuga, when in fact, that might not be what's going on. Also, we tend to project our own ideals, maybe that's the right word, our own ideals of what a perfect situation is like onto future ages. So let's take, for example, the idea, let's pretend we are in the Dark Ages. Let's pretend we are in the Kali Yuga. So what do you think a Kali Yuga mentality might imagine that an age of enlightenment or a perfect world might be like? Well, they're going to imagine, if they're in the Kali Yuga, that they've got 72 virgins, if they're a heterosexual male and that's what they're into. They're going to imagine that they have all the gold in the world. They're going to imagine that they have power over everything, world domination, every luxury afforded to them, because that is the way a Kali Yuga mentality thinks. It's the way a Kali Yuga mentality functions. The same is true as if you think that you are in an electric age. If you are in an electric age, which is when you have these massive advances in science and technology and understanding matter and physics and chemistry and so on, what are you going to imagine that a silver age or a golden age is going to be like? You're going to imagine probably that it's going to be like Star Trek. You know, you're going to have ships that fly through space, all these different worlds to explore. You're going to have the ability to beam yourself across planets. You're going to imagine that the individual has supreme autonomy due to technology. That is when you are perceiving things from, in a sense, an electric age mentality. And so you're going to think that the higher ages are simply going to be a glorified experience of the current age. So, for example, it's described that as one moves through the ages, that the bull of Dharma, now this is just a metaphor, but Dharma is this idea of perfect purpose and harmony. And the bull of Dharma has four legs. And it's said that in the Dark Ages, the bull of Dharma stands on one leg. So imagine a bull trying to stand on one leg. Well, at least it's got one leg, but it's not necessarily standing too well. In the Electric Age, or in the Dwapara Yuga, which we're currently in, the bull of Dharma stands on two legs. So the capacity for human consciousness to understand what is true is going to be only 50% developed by the time it gets into the end of the Dwapara Yuga, or the Electric Age. And remember, we're not very far into the Electric Age right now. When you get into the Treta Yuga, or the Mental Age, or Silver Age, well, then the bull of Dharma stands on three legs. Okay, well, that's pretty solid. A bull can probably get along with three legs. At least I've seen some dogs that can. And so then human consciousness, or consciousness really, becomes 75% developed, 75% capacity to understand the truth of its nature. And then when you get to the fourth age, the Golden Age, consciousness then stands, that bull of Dharma stands on all four of its legs. which means it's solid. It has every bit of understanding that it needs to know what it is, what it's all about. So we can't really understand, unless we've done some inner development, what the Silver Age and what the Golden Age is really all about. You know, this goes in a 24,000-year cycle, 12,000 years up, 12,000 years back. And so that means that, about 14,000 years ago would have been the time, the peak of the last Golden Age. And then individuals say, yes, but what about, why don't we find any evidence of these great civilizations? Why don't we find any evidence of this fantastic technology? Well, there's a few reasons. We do have some evidence of it in things like Stonehenge and these standing stones and various structures that are being discovered. And it makes sense that if anything is going to last 14,000 years, what do you think it is? Probably something like stone. However, on the other side of that, we have to remember this way that humans project their current ideals into other ages. So right now, being in the electric age, where we have instant communication across the globe, we have medicine like it's never been practiced before. And those of you who think medicine is barbaric, well, again, I'll agree with you on some of those points. But if you go back just 150 years ago, the individual who discovered that germs cause people to die after surgery, meaning they discovered that if a surgeon would actually wash his hands, that decreased the mortality rate, that was only discovered about 150 years ago. And that individual who discovered that was essentially committed to an insane asylum. So we've made quite a lot of advances. But back to this idea, we imagine that these enlightened civilizations, we project this idea that they're going to have this radical technology, that they're going to have cities in space, that they're going to have all of these things. But that's just because that's what our electric age understanding, that's all we can comprehend. What if we imagined that in the Golden Age, in the Silver Age, that humanity didn't need all the technology. They weren't stuck on Facebook, or they weren't stuck in their social media. They weren't profoundly alone. They weren't striving for meaning. They were able to embody what you might imagine a saint or a sage could embody, which is being content in nature, at peace with its surroundings. Think about Ramana Maharshi. He didn't travel further than his little mountain, Arunachala, once he got there, and he was content to be on his couch, to walk around Arunachala, to visit with the seekers that came to him. He was content. He, in my mind, represents what I could possibly imagine a Satya Yuga or Truth Age mentality to be. So imagine if the majority of the human population was that way. Do you think he would be sitting around surfing the internet? Do you think he would be feeling like he needed to travel the world and find all these interesting things to do? No, he would be content in himself, and there would be a harmony with the planet itself. So maybe the reason we don't have all of these discoveries or technologies from the Silver Age and Golden Age popping up in our archaeological digs is because the quality of human consciousness was so radically different we couldn't understand it, and that they actually lived simply more in harmony with life, with the world, with nature. And they did as many people, many hikers do. They go into the wild and they don't leave any marks. They do their best not to leave any trace. You'll find this in various other spiritual texts, this idea, and that is an enlightened age, a golden age mentality. So there's a lot to consider here, and you can start to grasp these concepts if you read the first portion of Sri Yukteswar's The Holy Science. And the reason I put this in the top four books, number three of all the four books that I find to be most important for Kriya Yoga practice, is because it puts into perspective where you are. Now, the other important part of this book is that Sri Yukteswar discusses sort of how creation happens, how human consciousness crystallizes into this little personality. And then he goes on to discuss how we reverse that. And he uses very Christian terminology because he had a profound interest in uniting the traditions of East and West. But he uses this idea of learning to hear the pranava or the om vibration or the amen, and that that is the word of God that leads you back to the realization of your source. And by practicing Kriya Yoga, by practicing any kind of effective meditation, really, you learn to calm down your senses. You learn to let go of attachment to your who you think you are, your personality, everything you think is so important. And by doing that, you become able to witness, to experience this word of God, this inner vibration. And that is a true baptism. You know, we have these ideas of baptism as though you dunk your head in water and then everything's miraculously better. Or in Kriya Yoga, it's initiation. You become initiated into the practice, and then all of a sudden, there's this idea that most of your karma is gone, and so you just keep meditating, it'll be all right. Part of that's true, but true baptism, true initiation is a new beginning. As you give up your small sense of self and you really give it up, you really let it go, you truly work on letting it go, you begin to more easily hear this inner vibration or feel it. Lahiri Mahasaya, Sri Yukteswar's teacher, he had said in one of his commentaries, I believe in the Bhagavad Gita, that even the body, the physical body itself, is a manifestation of the om vibration. So holding your awareness on the body itself, even if you can't hear the om, helps to attune you to this baptismal force. And the baptismal force is nothing religious. It's a true experience of letting go of everything which is not essential, of giving yourself fully to the truth of what you are. And the more you do that, and the more quickly you wake up through these stages of consciousness, and then you don't have to spend 12,000 years on this wheel of birth and death, theoretically reincarnating into ages that are appropriate to you, you can go all the way to the source in this lifetime. And that is the goal. It's not easy because you have to let go of everything that you're attached to, which brings us to another point that you tend to incarnate into the time or into the age or into the yuga that is appropriate to your current state of development. So if you are born into an age like the electric age, like we are in right now, that means that all the issues of the electric age, all the attachments that are there for the electric age, you incarnated theoretically in this time to go beyond them. And let's say that during this lifetime, you meditate well, you study your texts, you apply what you learn, and you really embody it. And so you eventually reach a state of development that is a silver age or golden age mentality, and your body passes away. Your body dissolves, as all of our bodies do at some point in time. Well, then when you come back around, do you have to theoretically reincarnate 80 years later in the same electric age? No, you have worked through all the issues of that particular age, because reincarnation doesn't have to be linear. You can pop back up in a silver age or a golden age. And if you maintain your awareness as a golden age individual, well, then it may be that if your body perishes in the golden age, then you wait another 24,000 years for the golden age to come around, because time is an interesting thing and usually only exists if you have a body, a physical body. And so then you are free in the sense of being able to embody the idea of the bull of Dharma standing on all four legs. So you will only incarnate usually during times that are supportive of what you know. Now, we know in Autobiography of a Yogi, there is this story of Sri Yukteswar showing up to Yogananda after he passed and saying that he has reincarnated on an astral planet called Hiranyaloka. And as he talks to Yogananda, he intimates that there are other planets in which life exists. And he calls it an astral planet. So there are even other planets which don't even exist in the physical plane. There are astral planets. So this breaks down our whole idea of linear time. It helps us to see that there are many different possibilities for human consciousness to experience life. And while we are so used to experiencing life in this physical flesh and blood form, that is only one way to experience it. So, the importance of Sri Yukteswar's book is he describes how creation happens, how to reverse that process. And I have found that many of the deeper meanings and the deeper understanding that one has as they practice meditation and Kriya Yoga, that information, you can put it into context by reading Sri Yukteswar's The Holy Science. It is a wonderful book, one of the most important books within the Kriya Yoga catalog of books to read. I would like to put it as number one or number two, but number one and number two, which we're going to get to here in a minute, they need to be understood first before you move on to something like the Holy Science. It is wonderful to read the Holy Science to start putting things into context for yourself, but what I have found is that once people begin reading and understanding what is shared in the top two books, the Holy Science makes a heck of a lot more sense. And that's been my own experience as well. I began reading the Holy Science as soon as I started practicing Kriya Yoga, because being an astrologer, Sri Yukteswar was an astrologer, I was drawn to his work, but I found that I didn't even begin to scratch the surface of understanding what he was trying to say, probably until after a decade or so of practicing Kriya Yoga. So let's move on to book number two. And book number two is the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Now, the reason I find this book to be so important is because it essentially tells you and outlines specifically what Kriya Yoga is. The Yoga Sutras of Patanjali are divided, or it is divided into four different sections, or four different parts. And the second part of the Yoga Sutras, the name of that part is Kriya Yoga. Kriya Yoga. And the very first sutra in that second part of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali tells you what Kriya Yoga is. It says that Kriya Yoga is intensity in spiritual practice, learning and application of one's own self-study, and the perfect alignment of attention with Ishvara, or the Lord of the universe, the wholeness of life, God. In section two of this book, there is the description of what Kriya Yoga is. Also, when Yogananda was leaving India for America, Sri Yukteswar told him to teach yoga from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Now, you can find many commentaries on this text. As far as a specific or specific books go, my two favorite are The Science of Self-Realization by Roy Eugene Davis. The Science of Self-Realization by Roy Eugene Davis. When I teach the Yoga Sutras to the Kriya Yoga students in the Kriya Yoga Apprenticeship Program, I teach it from the book Kriya Yoga, Continuing the Lineage of Enlightenment, which is a book I wrote. And that commentary that I have on the Yoga Sutras, it is based upon my own experience studying Mr. Davis's texts. I also did a course of study with Vyas Houston related to Sanskrit, and so I incorporated what I learned through his work, and early on, I had done some study with Dr. David Frawley, and so Kriya Yoga, Continuing the Lineage of Enlightenment, that commentary on the Yoga Sutras, that is a collection of my own understanding, my studies with David Frawley's work, Vyas Houston, as well as Roy Eugene Davis's work. So those would be my two top picks for descriptions on what the Yoga Sutras are all about. Another one, if you can find it, which is probably my all-time favorite commentary on the Yoga Sutras, is Life Surrendered in God. The Kriya Yoga Way of Soul Liberation. And this is a book that was also written by Roy Eugene Davis. It was one of the first books I ever got. It's a hardback book. I don't think it's in print anymore, but maybe you can find it on eBay or secondhand. Now, why is this book so important? As I mentioned, it is broken up into four sections. I particularly enjoy three of the four sections. The first section of the Yoga Sutras describes essentially what yoga is all about. It defines what the experience of yoga is. That yoga happens simply by ending the process of fluctuations and changes in the field of consciousness. You do that, you practice yoga. When you do that, then the seer abides in the seer's own true nature. So within the first three sutras, it tells you what it is. And then it follows up with, if you don't do that, otherwise there is conformity to definitions. That is Sutra 4 of the first chapter of the Yoga Sutras. So if you are not abiding in your own true nature, which you are not, if you are identified with changes and fluctuations in consciousness, then you are going to conform to definitions. And definitions are the things that you become attached to, the things that rise and fall, the things that come and go, the things that you think are so important. And in this first chapter of the Yoga Sutras, it goes on to discuss this philosophy, how it happens, what it's all about. In chapter 2 of the Yoga Sutras, there is an emphasis on, well, the direct practices that help to free one from their over-identification with these definitions in consciousness. And how do they start? Well, you begin by developing an intensive spiritual practice, learning an application of one's own self-study. Some translate that as learning practice of one's own personal mantra. And then that can be interpreted as though you're going to be doing a word, phrase, or a Sanskrit sentence that you repeat over and over. But mantra simply means that which takes us beyond the mind. So anything that takes us beyond the mind is important to understand. And the focus on self-study, the focus on one's own personal mantra, this is because we all respond differently to various types of practice. So you have to get a sense of how does your own unique expression of this individualized consciousness grow and develop. So that's why self-study is so important. But it's also self-study in the sense of the bigger you, the thing that is beyond this mind-body personality. If you're able to study that, identify with that, you begin to recognize what you're all about. And the final one, perfect alignment of attention with Ishvara. This often relates to the idea of surrender. And that is a topic that one typically doesn't understand until one lives a little bit of life. So we're not going to get into that so much today. Now in chapter 2, there's also an emphasis on the eight limbs of yoga, because it is through the eight limbs of yoga that you are able to practice intensively, that you are able to practice self-study, that you are able to figure out what does it mean to surrender to God or to have perfect alignment of attention with Ishvara. And these are the eight limbs that are common to the idea of Raja Yoga or Royal Yoga. They are Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, Samadhi. These are the eight limbs. Yama Niyama. Yama is nonviolence, truth, non-stealing, conservation of vital forces, and non-possessiveness. The universal disciplines are applicable no matter who you are, what you're all about, or where you are in life, or what circumstances you're in. Other important practices in the very beginning, purity, contentment, intensity in spiritual practice, practice of learned personal mantras, alignment of attention with the eternal self, these are the internal disciplines or the niyamas. And what do? These help to eliminate obstacles to your yoga practice. And they are the foundation for all practice. They are the foundation for all practice. And we explore this in detail in year two of the Kriya Yoga Apprenticeship course, because we do consider the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali as our primary source text during that time. So what the Yoga Sutras are doing are outlining, sharing with us the principles, the procedures, the ways of living which result in understanding what Kriya Yoga, what our meditation practice is all about. Chapter 3 goes more deeply into the idea of meditation, one-pointed meditation, internalization of awareness. And then Chapter 4 is on final liberation, the chapter on the aloneness of seeing. And in Chapter 4, what I enjoy about this chapter is that it puts into context, once you've been practicing for a while, and once you've had your own inner realizations and experience, and you're almost to the end of the road, what should you expect? What is it all about? What is going to be going on for you? So the chapter on final liberation helps to push you through the final veil of illusion, or delusion, I suppose. But it also gives you some understanding of, once you're almost there, what do you still got to work through? What do you still have to experience? So number two in this top four Kriya Yoga book review is the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. You can find a commentary that suits your own temperament. In my own teaching, I use Kriya Yoga, Continuing the Lineage of Enlightenment. I also recommend Roy Eugene Davis's book, The Science of Self-Realization, or if you can find it, Life Surrendered in God. Now, this leads us to the first and probably most important book in the Kriya Yoga tradition, and that is the Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. Now, it's not necessarily as detailed as the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali or as Sri Yukteswar's book, The Holy Science, but it's number one because it puts into context essentially what you are doing as a meditator, as one who has this ideal of enlightenment, or as one who wants to wake up from regular mortal human consciousness. It's a long book, and some have said it is the Bible of Hinduism, but it's more than that. It is a metaphor for the spiritual path. And if you're going to try to accomplish something or realize something, it really helps if you have source material that puts things into context so you understand what's going on. And that is essentially what the Bhagavad Gita does, if you look at it metaphorically, rather than looking at it as though it is an actual story about a war that happened thousands of years ago. Because the yogic importance of it is the metaphor or the analogy. At the very beginning of the story, we have Arjuna, who is representative of your own individualized consciousness, the seeker, the one who's going to become the Kriya Yoga master. And he is about to embark upon a war or a fight. And in the very beginning, it looks to him as though he's about to fight his kinsmen. He's about to fight his family. And he sees only misfortune, only destruction, only defeat, only difficulty by doing so. And luckily, his charioteer or his teacher, Krishna, represents supreme consciousness or clear consciousness, a consciousness which essentially understands all that needs to be understood. And Krishna encourages Arjuna to fight. Arjuna doesn't want to have anything to do with it. And this is like the beginning of our spiritual path. Most people do not want to do what really needs to be done to wake up, to be clear, to organize their life, to experience a more serene relationship with the wholeness of life. Why? Because they are attached and addicted to their habits of who they think they are, of their inclinations, of their selfishness, of their egotism. And that can be a very hard thing to shake. Just look around the world. Why do most people do what they do? Because they're greedy, because they're afraid that people are going to take advantage of them, because they don't want to be hurt, which makes sense. None of us wants to be taken advantage of or to be hurt. But when it comes to the spiritual path, we have to learn to shake off these shackles that keep us bound into a small sense of self, a small-minded sense of self. If an individual wants to live a life in normal human consciousness, there's nothing wrong with that. By all means, do it, knock yourself out. But since we are talking about Kriya Yoga and meditation and enlightenment and clarity, well, that tells us that you have deep down inside a compass that's pointing in a radically different direction. In the beginning, you might find that it is difficult to get up and meditate at the same time every day. Well, in a sense, that's like a habit that you don't want to get rid of. You want to sleep in. In the beginning, you might find that it's difficult to get up and do your hatha yoga routine or to start choosing friendships which are less dramatic. That's hard because you are identified with certain ways of being. In a sense, that's a very poor example, but in a sense, that is what Arjuna is facing, his inner resistance to change. Even individuals who have been practicing Kriya Yoga for many years or meditation for many years still can have profound attachments to family, sense of status, their home, their body. And the ultimate experience of yoga is to release attachment to all these things. So you can imagine why the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita is described as this war. And there are individuals on the other side which are against clarity of awareness, such as egotism, selfishness, and so on. But our meditation practices, learning to turn our awareness within and focus on, say, that inner sound current, the pranava, the word of God, or even using the theory of the chakras, by turning our awareness within, as is described in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, those things help to stir our spiritual energies towards clarity. So that's why it comes across as a war, and it comes across as a fight, and why the individual who's trying to wake up is, in a sense, seen as what you might consider to be a real hero. Not a hero who wants to be seen as a hero, but a hero who is doing one's duty. And as Krishna tells to Arjuna when he decides to drop his bow and slumps to the floor. Krishna says to him, "You who are of noble character, this is beneath you. Stand up and fight and do your duty." We are ultimately clear, serene spirit. But we mire ourselves down into attachments to everything that's going to change and fall away. And so we become miserable. We become petty. We become selfish. So the work of Kriya Yoga is to overcome all of these things. The work of Kriya Yoga is to begin applying what is described in the yamas and niyamas, harmlessness, truthfulness, non-possessiveness, purity, contentment, and so on. These are very difficult things to begin to do if you are raised in a culture or you have a current state of consciousness which does not appreciate that. And that's okay, because you have been born into a time when that is natural. If you were born into, say, the Treta Yuga, the Silver Age, or the Golden Age, it would be natural for you to want to take care of others, to not be selfish. It would be natural for you to be sacrificing. When it came to harming yourself or someone else, it would be as disgusting to you as drinking a cup of raw sewage, because that is what an enlightened, that is how an enlightened consciousness relates to what our most of our normal human condition could be. It's tasteless, right? So we find in the Bhagavad Gita, it is an allegory, and I really need to look up the difference between allegory, metaphor, and analogy, because I keep using them interchangeably. But it is an allegory for how the soul wakes up from being mired down into delusion. And I've gone through and I've taken notes on all of the qualities and characteristics described in the Bhagavad Gita. The overarching theme seems to be non-attachment. If one is able to live a life without attachment, it doesn't mean that they don't do anything, because they are still going to be inspired internally. But if they let go of their attachment to success and gain, pleasure and pain, heat and cold, and so on, they are going to embody an enlightened state. And that comes up over and over and over again in the Bhagavad Gita. Nowhere in the Bhagavad Gita does it say that if you practice yoga and spirituality, you will be a wealthy king for 10,000 years. Nowhere does it say that your physical form will live forever. It says you will recognize your immortality. It says that you will recognize that you have everything that you need, all by letting go of being concerned about whether you are praised or blamed, whether things go the way of the personality or not, whether you are experiencing heat or cold, whether you are homeless, whether you are loved or not. The beauty of the Bhagavad Gita is that not only is it this allegory of the spiritual path, but it illustrates the key characteristics of what an enlightened being naturally expresses. Now, in our current age, we often think of an enlightened being as either someone who just has a magical experience one day and wakes up and realizes it, or we imagine the enlightened being who is one who forces themselves to be patient, to be kind, to be harmless, to be content, to always tell the truth, because that's what we have to do now. As we've come out of the dark age, as we've moved into the electric age, we're just waking up. And so we have to force ourselves to do a little bit more. But once we are energized and healthy and happy, we will naturally be the way enlightened people are described to be. So with the Bhagavad Gita, what it is sharing with us is the qualities and characteristics that if we start embodying now, figuring out how do we move through our own traumas, our own selfishness, our own egotism, to really embody these things, we will naturally wake up. It tells you what those are. It lists them throughout all of the chapters. So if you go through the Bhagavad Gita and you start writing down, this is what the sage's experience is like, this is what the yogi's experience is like, and you start deciding that every day you are going to try to embody one of those, you're going to try to embody one of those until it becomes natural to you, then eventually you will recognize why it is so important, and you won't have to force yourself to do it anymore. And this applies across the board to numerous circumstances in life. When one wants to become a vegetarian or to eat a healthier diet, when they've got 30 or 40 years of eating a poor diet, of course it's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. You're going to crave the soft drinks and the French fries and the burnt steak and bacon. But what you find is, at least this is my experience, once I became a vegetarian and I started eating healthier and I started exercising regularly, I noticed how much happier, clearer, and healthier I was. And so it never became a question for me. Do I want to go exercise today? Do I want to not eat that nasty food 24 hours a day or three meals out of the day? No, because I recognized how it made me feel, and that was not an experience I wanted to have. The clarity, the energy, the strength of living a particular kind of lifestyle becomes apparent once you've done it for a while. You simply have to break through those habits. So the reason the Bhagavad Gita is so important, just to bring all this home, is because it describes to you what the experience of waking up is actually truly like. Once you get beyond the mythology, the fantasy, once you get beyond all your spiritual heroes acting like you can't achieve what they have achieved, well, they had to go through the same thing. The difference is they actually did it and you haven't yet. It illustrates for you what needs to be done and what it's going to be like. And then it also gives you this understanding of what the qualities and characteristics of one who embodies an enlightened state, what is that? And then you begin to do that yourself until it becomes as natural to you as whatever your current state of consciousness is. And then you will understand what it means to live in a Satya Yuga type of awareness. And then, of course, once you get there, you'll look around and you'll say, well, why doesn't everybody do this? And hopefully you will remember where you started at, and you'll see, ah, well, human consciousness just has all these different levels of stratification, and that as an individualized aspect of this one whole, by our actions, by our thoughts, by our words, by our choices, we, in a sense, choose to be where we are. Now, we're not going to get into karma there, because that can open up a whole other can of worms. But I, for the most part, have found that idea to be true. So the top four books for a Kriya Yoga practitioner. Number one, the Bhagavad Gita. Usually always start there. My favorite commentary on the Bhagavad Gita is Roy Eugene Davis's The Eternal Way. Roy Eugene Davis's The Eternal Way. It's clear, it's concise, it gets right to the point. Some people have told me that they enjoy Paramahansa Yogananda's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. He uses terminology that I don't, you know, I quit going to church for a reason. So I don't necessarily enjoy his work as much as Roy Davis's, because Mr. Davis's is very direct and very to the point. Eventually, hopefully sometime soon, I do have it on the agenda to begin my own commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And my goal with that is I want to take that commentary and put it together with my commentary on the Yoga Sutras, and put it together with the techniques of Kriya Yoga that I've written about in Kriya Yoga Vichara, and create a free ebook that essentially has the Yoga Sutras, the Bhagavad Gita, and the practices of Kriya Yoga for anyone who wants it. So as of now, it's the end of 2019. I'm going to give myself 6 months to do that. Let's see how it goes. I'll also turn it into a book that you can, a hardback, because I do enjoy personally having shelves of hardback books. It's an attachment of mine. So maybe someone else does too. The Bhagavad Gita, number one. The Yoga Sutras, number two. The Holy Science by Shriktishwar, number three. And Autobiography of a Yogi, to stay enthused and inspired upon the path. But if you are able to apply and understand what is written in the Yoga Sutras, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Holy Science, you are going to be very well off in regards to your spiritual practice, and specifically your Kriya Yoga practice. And this is the way that I have structured the Kriya Yoga apprenticeship program. The first year we explore the Bhagavad Gita. I think there's 27 different classes where we go through each chapter of the Bhagavad Gita and how it applies to us as a seeker on the path and eventual Kriya Yoga master. And in year two, we go into the Yoga Sutras so that we are able to understand in more detail what is the specific philosophy of Kriya Yoga, and how do we really lock on and go all the way in this lifetime. And the Holy Science, you will naturally find that to be enjoyable. So these are the top four books that I have found to be most important on the Kriya Yoga path, and also probably the order in which they can be read, although most people tend to read, as I did as well, Autobiography of a Yogi first.
This episode of the Kriya Yoga podcast was made possible by donations from Kriya Yoga apprenticeship students and supporters of our Patreon community at www.patreon.com/KriyaYoga.